Well, good evening, everyone. I hate to disappoint Jerry. But before we talk about the monk and the king, meaning Martin Luther, who was a monk, and Henry VIII, who was king, I'd like to look at some pre-Reformation Protestants, some people who protested against the church even before the Protestant Reformation began around 1500. Also, I'd like to begin this evening by finishing off our discussion of Eastern Orthodoxy by mentioning groups of Eastern Orthodox and occasionally other groups who decided that they had made a mistake and who decided that, in fact, they ought to be in communion with the Catholic Church. These groups, which have reunited with Rome, are often referred to as Uniate Christians, U-N-I-A-T-E, Uniate Christians. This word Uniate, as a way to describe these groups who had split from the church and are now reunited, is a word that was made up by the Monophysites. The Monophysites were the ones who believed one nature, monophysis. That was the Coptic church and the Ethiopian church and the Syrians and so on. And it was also made up by the Eastern Orthodox as a term of derogation. It was considered an insult because it implied that these people were betraying their national and cultural heritage by rejoining with the Latin church. So it was a term of disapproval. Consequently, these groups, which I'm going to discuss here in a second, don't like the name Uniate, even though that's still the common term for them. They prefer to be called Eastern Catholic Churches, which is a good name, since the majority of them have come back from one Eastern type of Christianity or another. The earliest group to have reunited is some Yugoslavians in southern Italy and Sicily. You'll remember we spoke last time how in the 800s the Pope wanted to make southern Italy Catholic rather than Orthodox, if you recall that. The split hadn't actually occurred yet, but spheres of influence. Well, those churches ceased being Orthodox and became Catholic. The Maronites. Someone last time. Yes, you. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, here they are. The Maronites are Lebanese Christians. Turns out that they're the largest single group of these Eastern Catholic rejoiners. If you put all of these groups together, all the ones that have ceased being in schism or in heresy and have reunited and are full-blown Catholics like the rest of us, it's about 12 million throughout the world. And the Maronites are about 1 million. So they're the largest single group among these Christians. Some of the Arminians are one of those Monophysite groups that broke away in 451 at the Council of Chalcedon. They reunited. Some of them reunited. There's majority didn't. But the ones who did and became Eastern Catholics reunited in 1150. Believe it or not, some of the Nestorians became Catholic. As a group, they decided to cease being Nestorians and they adopted the Catholic faith. That was in 1551. And they still are Catholics today. Ruthenians. Ruthenian is an adjective which refers to the Ukrainians and the Belarusians. If I had referred to these two groups a month ago, you'd probably say, well, Ukrainians I've heard of, but who the heck are the Belarus? But they've been in the news lately, right? Because the Ukrainians just had an election, and it went toward Russia, and the Belarus just had an election, and the dictator reasserted himself. Ruthenians, Belarusians, and Ukrainians, a number of them ceased to be Eastern Orthodox and reunited with Rome in 1596. What happened here was the Ukraine at this time did not belong under the sphere of influence of the Soviets. It was not one of the satellites, part of that Warsaw Pact. Instead, it was owned by Poland. The King of Poland owned Ukraine. And so the King of Poland said, he was dyed-in-the-wool Catholic, as most Poles have been, he said to this province of his kingdom, you guys need to get with the program. You know, you either become, he said to all the bishops, you either become Catholic or you cease to be bishops. This was in 1596. Let me see here. I don't know how many there were, but all but two of them said, okay. And they became Catholic. Those Eastern Orthodox in other areas were quite miffed at this, and they invented the term Uniates for these traitors. Some of the Romanians ceased to be Eastern Orthodox. Remember Transylvania?
Yeah.
Ivan Tusakioblad. They became Catholic in 1698. Excuse me. A group of Syrian Christians. The Syrian Christians were called the Jacobites. They're Monophysites. Some of them rejoined Catholicism in 1724. So we've got these approximately 12 million people who have rejoined the Catholic Church over the centuries. Now, each of these groups is required to hold the Catholic faith. So they believe exactly the same faith you do. And they say exactly the same creed you do. So, for example, if they were Eastern Orthodox and they were used to saying the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father, they now say the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. Remember that word filioque we talked about last time? So they're completely in harmony with it. Plus, they have all seven sacraments exactly the same way we do, and they do them at the same time. We saw last time that the Eastern Orthodox, typically 8 days after birth, will baptize a baby, will confirm a baby, and will take a little tiny piece of consecrated host and give First Communion all on the same day, 8 days after birth. That's the Eastern Orthodox practice. But these groups who have rejoined with us still follow our practices in those regards. But the Vatican has said to these groups ever since they've rejoined us, you may keep your structure. So if you're used to having a local guy there in the Ukraine to whom you look for guidance, a patriarch, go ahead. You can continue to be the patriarch or the metropolitan or whatever structure, hierarchical structure they had developed prior to becoming Catholic. Besides which, we saw last time that Eastern Orthodox, at least, have a married clergy, right? How exactly did that go? The parish priests can get married, but if you want to be a bishop, you have to be unmarried. So the Catholic Church says to these groups, you could keep that custom. So there's an instance of married Catholic priests, because these are genuine Catholics. That, I suppose, would be of some interest in considering the question whether or not the Catholic Church can get rid of clerical celibacy or not. Some people argue that it's apostolic and it goes all the way back. But then the question would be, well, how come we're letting these guys do it then? I don't want to get into that because I don't know the answer. But it does kind of make me wonder. They also have different liturgies. There are five distinct Eastern rites, as they're called. One is called the Byzantine Rite. That's the most significant. And there's 16 branches of it. One is called the Alexandrian. That's what the Copts and the Ethiopians use. One's called the Antiochene. One's called the Chaldean. One's called the Arminian. And just as the originating groups, like the Arminian Monophysites, developed this particular way of doing their rites, Eucharist, for example, baptism, for example, so those who have rejoined with the Catholic Church are allowed to go ahead and practice the rites as they were developed in these other churches. So the Catholic Church actually has 6 rites. There's the 5 that one finds having been imported by these Eastern Catholic groups, and then there's the one that we use, the Novo Ordo. Yeah, you had your hand up, sir?
So all of these groups have their own, if you will, churches then that are distinct from Roman Catholic churches and parishes. Is that right? Or
if you walked into one, it would bear the impression of whatever culture it came from. Where's the lady that was speaking to us the other day who had been raised in an Eastern Catholic church? Is she here tonight? Do you recall the woman I'm referring to? That's too bad. I wanted to ask her what she had come from. I mean, you know, what nationality her church had come from. But it sounded to me from her description as if when you walk into it, you'll see icons painted on the walls and so on. So it's you're perfectly welcome to have communion there whenever and as often as you like, because these are genuine Catholic churches. But they do have this kind of distinct flavor of whatever national or cultural ambit they come from.
Several years ago, when St. George's, a Maronite church, was dedicated in Austin, the bishop, Greek Orthodox bishop from San Antonio, concelebrated with him, and I received communion from him. So do they get along with the Roman and the Orthodox? Apparently.
I'm assuming that that church was a Eastern Catholic.
Maronite.
Yes,
it was a Maronite Catholic. I thought it was unusual at the time, but
I believe it's the case in canon law that according to Catholicism, Eastern Orthodox priests genuinely consecrate, and their Eucharist is equally as valid as ours. So you can receive communion there. But there are also instances where religious ceremonies have occurred with both Catholic priest and Protestant on the stage, so to speak. That's probably not going to be a Eucharist, you know, but it'll be interfaith dialogue or prayer service or something of that sort. Eastern Orthodox are considered to be in schism. Schizo in Greek means tear. So they're torn from us, but we don't consider them heretical. Protestants, on the other hand, have major beliefs that differ from ours and therefore would be considered heretical, heresy meaning the beliefs of a minority that diverge from the majority. So I think that's why canon law specifies that you can intercommunicate with Eastern Orthodox, but you can't with Protestant. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about those Uniate or Eastern Catholic churches. Yes, sir?
Yeah, I've got a question. Do the Eastern Orthodox, do they believe in the authority of the Pope?
Eastern Orthodox do not. Eastern Catholic do. The Eastern Catholic churches are those relatively small numbers of Eastern Orthodox or Nestorians or Arminians or Copts or whomever who have left their original breakaway group and have rejoined us, so they recognize the Pope. But Eastern Orthodox, no. That's one of the major difficulties that we're going to have in ever healing that schism, because they do not recognize the universal jurisdiction of the Pope. Okay, we are wending our way toward the Protestant Reformation, and we'll be in it in full swing the entire second half of our series is going to be about Protestantism. I thought it might be of some interest, however, if we were to look at some ways in which the kind of tendency that Protestantism represents appears in the centuries prior to Protestantism. The traditional date for Protestantism is 1517, the year in which Protestantism began. We'll look at why next time. But were there no protests against Catholicism in the 1400s, or the 1300s, or the 1200s, or the 1100s? Indeed, there were. They're not very well known, but I think that they were pretty important in preparing the ground for the ultimate break that occurred in 1517. So in order for us to put the Protestant Reformation in a broader context, I would like for us this evening to consider these protest movements that occurred roughly from 1000 to 1500. Remember, we sort of divided the ancient church is up to 500, the Dark Ages are 500 to 1000, Middle Ages are 1000 to 1500. So tonight we're dealing with the Middle Ages. First group I'd like to mention to you are the Cathari, C-A-T-H-A-R-I. Do you remember, those of you who were here that first night, we discussed an ancient heresy called Gnosticism. Gnosticism means knowledgeism. They believe that you're saved by knowledge. You had to memorize certain sets of passages and so on. Gnosticism went underground, probably about 300. And I mentioned that evening that it seems to have resurfaced later. Did we talk about the Masons? Yeah, okay. Well, in between Gnosticism going underground around 300 and the Masons appearing somewhere in the Renaissance, I think, 1600s, 1700s, I don't know exactly, Gnosticism did resurface kind of in between. And this resurfacing is primarily with this group called the Cathars. Now, there were a couple of groups prior to them, Gnostic groups. They didn't still use the name Gnosticism. I'm not sure they even knew much about Gnosticism. But there was a group called the Paulicians, and there was a group called the Bogomils. The Bogomils were in Bulgaria. The Paulicians were in Asia Minor and Armenia. And they were suppressed as heresies by the church in those areas. Well, all that did was force these crypto-Gnostics to head westward. And what was west was northern Italy and southern France, that latitude there. So we wind up with, in the 1100s, the Cathars, who seem to have derived their beliefs from these immigrant Gnostics. The Cathari had a system that divided their followers, their members, into two groups. There was the group which was 98% of Cathari, who were just ordinary married men and women, peasants for the most part on medieval farms. But then there was that elite group, 3%, 5%, something like that. And these were known as the Perfecti. The Perfecti, dressed all in black, had a vow of celibacy, wandered the countryside with a staff, fasted rather extremely. They would fast on bread and water at least two or three times a week, and then they would have three 40-day periods throughout the year that they would fast on nothing but bread and water. So these people were considered saints on earth. They represented God on earth, almost as if they were incarnations of God, the way you and I regard Jesus. If you were a Cathari and one of these Perfecti walked past your farm on the road, you would rush up to him, embrace him, kiss him, beg for his intercession. By 1200, these Cathari had organized themselves, had become so numerous that they had organized themselves into rival dioceses in northern France and in northern Italy and southern France. So the church, in order to respond to this, cracks down, and we're going to talk about that in a second. Before we talk about that, however, I'd like to mention another group that arises about this time, somewhere around 1200. And this is a group known as the Waldensians. At first, the Waldensian didn't have that name. They went by the name Poor Men of Lyon. Lyon, L-Y-O-N-S, is a city today in southern France, town back then. And there were certain men in that town who were inspired to practice the evangelical counsels. That's C-O-U-N-S-E-L-S, in the sense of advice, not ecumenical counsels. In the sayings of Jesus, you'll find passages where he seems to suggest that living without material possessions is a extraordinary show of piety. Living a celibate existence is an extraordinary way of life. These are the evangelical counsels. You'll find the celibacy, for example, in Mark 10, if you want to check it. There are eunuchs who are born eunuchs. There are eunuchs who are made eunuchs. There are eunuchs for this kingdom of God. The rich young man, which I think is Luke 17. What must I do to be saved? You know the Ten Commandments. Honor your father and mother. Do not kill. Do not murder. Hey, great. I've done those all my life. What else? If you would really be perfect, sell all your possessions and come follow me. These evangelical councils inspired the rise of the monastic movement, the monks and the nuns that we have with us today. Movements which largely started flourishing in the 200s and 300s AD. Well, the Waldensians seem to have, or Poor Men of Lyon, as they were originally known, seem to have been inspired by the same desire for practicing the Christian life with more vigor and more rigor. Now, this same impulse toward living the Christian life with greater strictness surfaced not just with the Waldensians, but at virtually the same time, it also shows up in two new religious orders. These two new religious orders are the Franciscans and the Dominicans. The Pope officially recognized the Franciscans in 1215, and he officially recognized the Dominicans in 1217, and the Franciscans have never let the Dominicans forget that. Now, these two groups wanted to practice the evangelical councils in a very strict kind of way. The Franciscans did not want to be called monks, like the earlier orders, you know, the Benedictines and the Cistercians and so on. They all lived in community by themselves, apart from the world. These Franciscans wanted to travel around. They wanted to have no possessions, and therefore they would have to beg. If you beg, then you are a mendicant. That's just a Latinate word for beggar. Both of these groups are mendicant orders, but they're not called monks, they're called friars. That's because they're much better tasting if you don't bake them. Friars means that they don't live in community like this. They're out in the world. In fact, a Dominican will have after his name the initials OP. That does not stand for out of print. That means Order of Preachers, because Dominic Guzman, the Spaniard who founded the order in 1217, wanted his men to go out and preach to the people. The difference, however, between the Franciscans and the Dominicans, who wound up getting recognized and approved of by the Pope, versus the Poor Men of Lyon, or Waldensians, as they later came to be known, is that the Franciscans and Dominicans remained Orthodox. The Waldensians did not. They developed beliefs that are contrary to the Catholic faith. One of those beliefs was that everybody must practice the evangelical counsels. Orthodox Catholicism says those are councils. You know, Jesus says if this is your calling in life, if you're called to this sort of existence, then do so. But it's not de rigueur, it's not required of every one of his disciples. The Waldensians, however, thought that this ought to be applied to all Christians. It's a kind of an elitism. It's not all that different from the elitism that one sees in Catharism. A second belief that the Waldensians developed that caused them to be heretical is that they reduced the sources of authority in religion to the Bible. It has always been the case in Catholicism that we have recognized two sources for information about our faith. If you want to know what the Catholic Church believes, you look at the Bible, that's one of the two sources, and you look at tradition. Tradition is the other source. We look at the church fathers, we look at past church councils, we look at papal declarations, we look at past theologians, Thomas Aquinas and so on, Augustine. We use tradition to help us interpret Scripture. These fellows, however, did away with all of tradition. No more church fathers, no more councils. If it's in the Bible, believe it. If it's not in the Bible, don't believe it. That, of course, is one of the main characteristics of Protestantism, isn't it? So here it is showing up 300 years before Protestantism shows up. So it was kind of in the air as a way of protesting the status quo. Interestingly enough, this urge or impulse to reduce all religious authority to the Scriptures alone also happened in Judaism. In Judaism, Orthodox Judaism is called Rabbinic Judaism because the rabbis from 70 AD, when the temple was destroyed and has never been rebuilt, from then onward, not the priests, but the rabbis, the local guys out in the villages, were the source of authority. And they developed a tradition, which one finds in the later books like the Mishnah and the Talmud and so on, which was considered to be authoritative. Lo and behold, about 600, a group of Jews broke away from that tradition. They're known as the Karaites, and their main tenet or belief was the Bible alone. You don't have to abide by all these decisions that rabbis have made over the centuries. You just go with the Bible. Now, of course, these are Jews, so for them, the Bible is the Old Testament. No New Testament in there. But still, it's the same impulse. You can see how that... And it's probably a perennial temptation as a way of people who want to simplify religion or people who want to return to the purity of the early church, I think, find that idea attractive of returning to Scripture alone. Yes?
But this idea of traditionalism in the Catholic Church didn't really come about to the Council of Trent, didn't it? That's when it was first brought up by the church.
It was made an explicit doctrine. It was made an explicit dogma by the Council of Trent around 1550. But it had been practiced for 1500 years. The people at Council of Constantinople won in 381, based themselves upon the Council of Nicaea in 325, etc. It's a kind of a cumulative movement through time. Oh, okay, thank you. These Waldensians, like the Cathars, had no possessions. They wandered the countryside. They were respected by the peasants, who liked to contrast them to the overly opulent higher clergy, bishops, archbishops, cardinals with their red hats and the big pink thing in the middle and all that, you know. So it was a way for people to protest against the church, And there was a lot in the church worth protesting against. We talked last time about how coming out of the Dark Ages, when the whole level of civilization dropped tremendously, the church tried over and over again to lift itself by its bootstraps in all those reforming councils throughout the Middle Ages. Remember that? So certainly there was plenty to be remedied, but the Waldensians were not the way to do it. They, in effect, threw away Catholicism and started their own pre-Protestant Protestantism, in a way.
How did they interpret the scriptures? Very strictly, sola scriptura, so to speak, or literally, or how liberally did they interpret the scriptures?
Their tendency was to be literalists. They tended toward what you and I would nowadays call fundamentalism. So they were not allegorists the way a lot of the medieval theologians had been, or some of the church fathers. Yeah, good question. All right, next century. In the 1300s, I take that back. Hold off on that for a second. I want to talk about how did the church respond to the Cathars and the Waldensians. The church made a mistake. The church invented the Inquisition. Where do I get off saying that was a mistake? Well, don't blame me. In 2000, John Paul II apologized to the whole world for the Inquisition, as well as for the Crusades, other things we've done that we're not proud of. The Inquisition originated, best we can tell, in the year 1231. In 1231, the Pope at that time put out a papal bull. That's from the word bulla, which means stamp. You know, they pour the candle wax and put a stamp on it to seal the document. Okay. It was called Excommunicamus et Anathematissamus, and it excommunicated all Cathars and all Waldensians. It also said that there were to be trials of heretics, or when people were accused of heresy. Heretics so accused who were found guilty did not have a right of appeal, and they could not be represented by lawyers. That sort of makes sense, really, because for a lawyer to represent someone who's been found guilty of heresy would mean that lawyer was a heresy, so they're not going to find a lawyer anyway. Both of the new mendicant orders immediately became involved in this new institution that we call the Inquisition. And throughout its existence, for the next 400 or 500 years, the Dominicans more so, but also the Franciscans, are the primary inquisitors. Torquemada, the most famous of all the inquisitors in the 1500s, was a Spanish Dominican.
What was the time period of the Inquisition? When did it start and when did it end?
1231 seems to be my best guess from my research as to when it began. Other scholars have proposed other dates, but that seems to me best. And I apologize, I don't have a closing date. Maybe that's because the Inquisition evolved. So it's hard to say when the medieval Inquisition ended. What it evolved into was what was known in the 16, 17, 18, 1900s as the Holy Office, which was that agency within the Vatican bureaucracy that was in charge of maintaining doctrine. It's called the Holy Office. And then somewhere around in the 1950s, the Holy Office changed its name again. I don't know exactly when. I know in 1949, it was still called Holy Office. And in Vatican II, it's got the new name. So somewhere in there it changed. Nowadays, it's known as Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. So that ultimately had its origins as the Inquisition. But as far as the Inquisition going medieval on people, I don't know when that ended, but my guess would be around 1600 or in the 1600s. Now, that first document that I referred to, the Bula, was in 1231. 20 years later, in 1252, there's another papal bull, Ad Extirpanda, which adds new church law, and these new laws say you can use torture as a means to obtain confessions. You can use the death penalty, which is burning at the stake, and it instituted a police force that was at the behest of the inquisitors. Now, because the inquisitor was simultaneously the judge and the prosecuting attorney, you've obviously got huge room for abuses here, and I'm sure abuses occurred, and probably in increasing numbers as the centuries went by. But these earliest inquisitors, from the records that we still have of their trials, seem to have been pious men who genuinely wanted to serve the church. Here's a quotation. This is from W.L. Wakefield, Heresy, Crusade, and Inquisition in Southern France, 1100 to 1250. Implacable as the Inquisition seems to modern eyes, the inquisitors did act in a scrupulously legal manner, as they saw legality in those early days. They did use discretion in fitting penance to the offense, and they were not without conscience. Trial transcripts reveal honest men working painstakingly for their faith. That's from a non-Catholic historian. Here comes the microphone. Yeah.
To me, it just makes me think, we have freedom of choice. And the church with the Inquisition was not allowing the people to have freedom of choice. They were trying to force them through torture or whatever to choose the religion that they feel to save their souls. But yet we were supposed to have free choice.
Yes, you're quite right. Mm-hmm. I think the big difference is the narrowness of the medieval worldview versus the breadth of the modern worldview. In medieval times, they didn't know America existed. They didn't know Central America, South America existed. They didn't know Australia was over there. They didn't know Russia existed. Maybe a handful of leaders like popes or kings might know of it, but the ordinary people, for them, Christendom, what you and I call Western Europe, was the whole world. Go past Christendom and you fall off. So since 96% of all humanity is Christian, you know, you got a sprinkling of Jews among us, and there's those guys called Muslims over there at the edge who are troublesome. But otherwise, they had a very circumscribed view of the world. And for them, everybody's already heard about Christianity. Everybody knows everything there is to know about Christianity. If anybody isn't a Christian, they are grave sinners. Another problem with the medieval worldview, in my opinion, is that they were very naive concerning the psychology of conversion. They thought you could go up to somebody who wasn't a Christian, you could say to them, Christianity's the true religion, and instantly this person should fall on his knees and beg for baptism. It doesn't work that way. But there's nothing in all of their records to suggest that they took into account the fact that Jews and Muslims and heretics were raised to believe what they believe. So there's the influence of their parents there, and you're supposed to honor your mother and your father. They didn't take into account social pressure of the group to which they belonged. They didn't take into account that, for example, for a Muslim to leave the faith is to be damned eternally or killed. So it's just a different worldview from yours and mine. They were wrong. I believe it, you believe it, John Paul II agrees. In heaven, he still agrees with us. So I think that's why there's this difference that you see. Much better now that we allow for free will the way you're talking.
Question, this was occurring at the same time as the tail end of the Crusades. Was this impacted by the Crusades, any at all?
Yes. Crusades are 1095 to 1278. There's nine crusades. They all occurred within that period, 1095 to 1278. So here we are, first half of the 1200s. In fact, the Pope declared a crusade not against the Muslims to free the sacred Christian sites in the Holy Land so the pilgrims could reach them in safety. That was the main reason for the crusades. He decreed a crusade against the Cathari. And sure enough, a bunch of crusaders got together, went to southern France, went to northern Italy. They went to one town we have record of. They massacred 7,000 people in one day who were Cathari. That's referred to, there's another name for the Cathari. They're called the Albigensians because the region of Albigensia is in southern France. So this is referred to as the Albigensian Crusade. It's not one of the normal nine that are referred to. The Inquisition seems to have suppressed the Cathari and the Waldensians. They disappear. Now, it may be that these latter-day Gnostics that we call Cathari went underground again and reappeared later, maybe in the Mason movement or elsewhere. And certainly the Waldensians, with their belief in sola scriptura, may well have influenced others, but they disappear as an organized movement. They cease to exist. But they are not the only groups that the Inquisition was used against. There's another group that appeared in the later 1200s and in the 1300s. These are known as the spiritual Franciscans, or as they like to be called, the Fraticelli. And you thought that was a type of pasta. Fraticelli means brothers. They considered themselves brothers. As the adjective indicates, these were Franciscans, but when Francis died, I think in the 1270s, I don't have that date in front of me, there was a split in his movement. The conventual Franciscans, I used to have a spiritual director who was a conventual Franciscan, they looked at the writings of Francis and said, these are an ideal. We're supposed to try to live up to these as best we can. The spiritual Franciscans, who broke away and became a minority opposed to the majority of Franciscans, said, no, they're not an ideal. He intended these word for word, and we have to literally follow them in every detail. The spiritual Franciscans become an object of concern for the Inquisition, and they are suppressed by the Inquisition. They developed certain heretical ideas which brought them to the attention of the Inquisition. For example, there was a self-proclaimed prophet back in those days, Franciscan, whose name was Joachim of Fiore. And Joachim had come up with the idea that there are three ages to the world. All of world history can be divided into three ages. There's the age of the Father, that's the Old Testament period. There's the age of the Son, that's from Jesus up until the year 1000. And now, this guy is prophesying as the year 1000 is approaching, now there's going to be the age of the Holy Spirit, and it will be inaugurated by a new religious order. Well, hey, we spiritual Franciscans just came on the scene. He's talking about us. We're going to be the new church. And they cease to consider themselves Catholic. They consider themselves a new religion. So for these reasons, they came under the scrutiny of the Inquisition and were ultimately excommunicated by the papacy and suppressed. Sorcery also wound up being an object of interest for the Inquisition. That's what we mostly associate it with. You don't hear much about sorcery or magical practices being a concern to the church prior to 1250. But when the Waldensians and the Cathars were suppressed, they had to flee the cities and the towns, and the only place they could go was out into the mountains of northern Italy and southern France. And it's out in the mountains that the most backward, the Hicks, the Rubes, are living, the ones who have still maintained ancient magical practices about amulets and talismans and all that kind of stuff. So these heresies become mixed in with ideas about magic, and so sorcery becomes part of the object of investigation. Another heretical group, oh, I should mention, of course, as you all know, eventually that became a kind of collective mental illness in the 1500s, 1600s with the witch craze throughout Europe and then in New England as well. Another heretical group in the 1400s is the Beguines. There's some song about that. Begin the Beguine. How does that go? There you go. That's it. Yeah. Is that Cole Porter? Who did that? Is that Cole Porter? Okay, good. The Beguines were women. It was an order of women. There was a less important order of men who were associated with them, who were called the Beguards. Not spouses, no. That's now. They took an oath of chastity, both groups did. They lived a common life. The women lived as nuns in the convent, and the men lived as monks by themselves. But they associated, had lunches on Sundays or whatever. These groups were in search of ecstatic visions. They wanted religious excitement. This too is a perennial tendency, I think, within religion. In fact, this desire for visible, palpable manifestations of the Holy Spirit is technically referred to in theology as enthusiasm. Our word enthusiasm is from an ancient Greek word, enthusiasmos. Thus is a root which means spirit. So en thus means possession, being possessed. So that's why this word originally, prior to its current use in our language, for somebody who looked real excited about something, meant people who want this kind of, who want Pentecost all the time. Kind of like the charismatic order now, which I'm not saying is in any way heretical. I don't know much about it. But that's the same kind of tendency that one sees, or Pentecostalism and so on. This is something that one sees in most every age. At any rate, these people were like that. We don't know if they were actually associated with the Fraticelli, but they had that same kind of tendency toward hysteria. The New Age is dawning, and we're the true ones, and everybody else is passé. And so they wound up being suppressed as well. The Inquisition ultimately died out in France, in Italy, in Germany, where it had its last efflorescence and its greatest manifestation was in Spain. Spanish Inquisition was founded, let me get a date for you, 1478. And so it's throughout the 1500s that one always sees the Inquisition portrayed in Hollywood movies and so on. Okay, so now here are some movements, not the Franciscans and Dominicans, of course, but these others are kind of protest movements that occur in the Middle Ages, between 1000 and 1500. I now want to mention a couple of individuals who were influential and who were considered heretical by the church in this period. The first of them died, we don't know exactly when he was born, but he died in 1383. His name was John Wycliffe. Have you heard that name? Yeah, that's right. And isn't there some publisher named Wycliffe now? Some Protestant publishing house? I think so. Sometimes it's spelled with an extra F-E at the end. I don't know which is preferable. You just see it sometimes one way, sometimes the other. John Wycliffe was a professor of Scripture. He was a professor at Oxford University. He came up with the same idea, or it may be that he was influenced by, the Waldensians, because he also maintained that Scripture alone is the source of authority in religion. And that's his chief claim to fame, is the Waldensians said that, but it didn't have much impact. Wycliffe said it, and because he was a professor, because he knew how to read and write well, his writings spread this idea around that Scripture is the only source of authority. This idea was attractive to some people because they saw it as perhaps a way of ridding the church of certain practices that one saw in the church and that ought not to have been going on, such as simony. We mentioned simony the other day. Simony means the buying or selling of religious things, usually religious offices. So, I'm a businessman in the Middle Ages. I'm wealthy. I want to make more money, so I buy the local bishopric where the bishop has just died. I buy it. The neighbor bishop takes me through deacon, priest, bishop, and I now get the revenue from that bishopric. This happened quite a bit. Those are the sorts of abuses that the church was trying to stamp out in those reform councils. And some people looked at this idea, Bible alone, maybe if we got rid of that whole hierarchy up there and everything else, things would be all simple and we could return to the pure early church and it'd all be a golden age again. Wycliffe translated the Bible into English. Of course, he's at Oxford, so he's a British English speaker. But he also added footnotes throughout his translation, which were sometimes heretical, such as promoting the idea that the Bible alone is the only source for religious authority. But at other times were just downright insulting to the church. Either way, the spread of his translation increased unrest and protest in Europe, and therefore the church suppressed it. It tried to stamp out that particular translation. Not so much for the translation itself, but because of the tendencies that were in the footnotes. A number of men went to Oxford specifically for the purpose of studying under Wycliffe. They agreed with his ideas. They became known as the Lollards. If I remember right, that word comes from the fact that people said they talk a lot. They're always going, law, 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 law. These men became missionaries when they graduated from Oxford. They spread throughout England, reproducing this translation and spreading the ideas of Wycliffe. Lollardry was a movement that the church tried to suppress in the 1400s. So now there's John Wycliffe, professor. The other individual whom I'd like to refer to died in 1415. And that is another John, John Hus. Sometimes you'll see it spelled with two S's. Hus was a priest, as had been Wycliffe, and he was also a professor. He was a professor of philosophy. He was a native of what you and I now know as the Czech Republic. So he lived in Bohemia, kind of central Europe. He was influenced by Wycliffe. Wycliffe's writings had filtered, not just his translation of the Bible, but other writings of his tracts, had filtered kind of underground throughout Europe. And these came into the hands of Hus. One of the things that bothered Hus at the time, and bothered a lot of people at the time, was the fact that the church owned huge amounts of land in Europe. Over the centuries, people upon their deaths would donate their manor or their farm or whatever to the church upon death. And so over the centuries, the church became the single largest landowner in all of Christendom. It wound up owning, I don't know, maybe a fourth of all arable land, or maybe even a third. It's kind of interesting. I know that that happened in Buddhism as well. If you had gone to a Buddhist country in, let's say, 1900, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, any of those, you would have seen that the Buddhist monasteries in that country are the owners of over half of all the arable land. It had just happened that way over a couple thousand years. That's no longer the case because of revolutions that went on in the 40s and 60s and so on. But it seemed to have been similar in medieval Europe. This was a great source of resentment for the peasantry in medieval Europe, the fact that the church owned all the land. It reduced them to serfs. They couldn't have their own plot of land to grow their own vegetables for themselves and their families, but they had to give everything to the church and receive back whatever the church decided to give them. In addition, once we've reached this period, second half of the 1300s, early 1400s, the church is in the reputation of the church is at a very low ebb. And this is because of something that we refer to as the Great Schism. Yeah, Eastern Orthodoxy is a schism, but hey, this is a great schism. The Great Schism was from 1378 to 1417. What happened was, in 1378, the Pope died. And it was time for the cardinals to all get together in conclave and decide who's going to be Pope next. Half the cardinals voted for one guy, and the other half refused to recognize him. So they voted their own guy. Consequently, starting in 1378, you got two popes. And all of the countries of Europe aligned themselves with one or the other. You know, Switzerland might go for Pope A, France might go for Pope B, Germany says A, Italy says B, England, whatever. Not only the countries, but all of the great monasteries throughout Europe. Cluny might go for A, Citeaux might go for B, etc. So it caused a great division within Christianity, and it caused a lot of confusion and consternation among the people in the pews. Who's the real Pope? Who's in charge of us? What's going on? So this caused the respect for the church to take a nosedive. What really caused it to take a nosedive was shortly after 1400, the Pope, one of these two popes, died, and he got replaced. Then the other pope died, and he got replaced. It's starting to be institutionalized that we've got two popes, like a two-headed beast. The emperor, Holy Roman Empire, the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire at this time was King Sigismund of Hungary, and he forced the Pope to call a general council. It's one of those general councils that you'll find. And there, both popes were forced to abdicate the papacy. And then a third pope was given the papacy, a freshly elected pope. It didn't work. Both popes went off to their own constituencies And voila, you got three popes. So you can see that respect for the hierarchy goes down the tubes. To rectify this situation, the church holds a general council called the Council of Constance. Council of Constance was in 1415. And yes, if you notice, that's the same year that Hus died. That's no coincidence. The Council of Constance, ecumenical council of the church, burned him at the stake, I'm sad to say. What's worse is he was promised safe conduct. They told him, if you come and present your views so that we can consider them and say they're wrong, they didn't say that, but that's what they were planning, we guarantee you safe conduct to and from the council. But once he got there, they threw him in jail, tried him, declared him a heretic, and burned him at the stake. So what had Hus done that deserved burning at the stake? John Hus, H-U-S, excuse me. Well, he also, having been influenced by Wycliffe, argued that the scriptures alone are the only source for the only authority in religious matters. He seems to have had a somewhat idealized notion of the church, somewhat along the lines of the perfecti of the Cathari, or the poor men wandering the countryside of the Waldensians. He seemed to want a church of saints, whereas Catholicism has always said the church contains both saints and sinners. Hus's death made him a martyr and resulted in a focusing of concentration by all those groups anywhere in the empire, anywhere in Christendom, who felt that they had some kind of a beef with the church. It might be peasants who are angry that the church owns most of the land. It might be the Waldensians underground now who feel that they've gotten a bad end of it. It might be the Fraticelli. Hus becomes kind of a lightning rod for that, because his execution was so obviously public, taking place at a general council. All of these movements that we've looked at tonight, the Cathari, the Waldensians, the Fraticelli, the Beguines and the Bagards, Wycliffe and Hus, throughout the Middle Ages, all of these movements are what we've concentrated on this evening, because we're talking about Protestantism next time. And so we want to see how Protestantism was led up to, and how the ideas that were incorporated into Protestantism weren't all new, but rather a number of them were in the air, so to speak, at the time. But I don't want you to get the opinion or get the feeling that the church was in desperate straits throughout these 500 years of the Middle Ages. Yes, there was a lot that needed reforming. Yes, there was a lot of intolerance because of the cultural blinders that everybody wore at that time. Aquinas says that heresy is an offense against the state because it's subversive for the state to be a heretic. They didn't see the world the way we do. But I don't want you to concentrate so totally on this that you forget that our Holy Church was holy throughout that period, as it is in all periods. And we got lots of great saints who did lots of great things during these centuries. Not just St. Dominic, not just St. Francis, but Catherine of Siena, St. Thomas Aquinas, etc. And the church as a whole functioned as it always has, providing the Eucharist for us and so on. It remained the means of salvation then as now. So even though we've concentrated on those who had a beef with it, don't forget that the church was a wonderful thing and is still. There was a hand here.
Yeah, you've talked about the peasants' feelings in some cases about the churches owning land and other wealth. You briefly touched on the emperor, Holy Roman Emperor. But I wonder if you could talk, say some about the role of the aristocracy in all this, who must have had some jealousies also about the church's wealth and power, and what role, because I'm thinking they must have played some role in the Protestant movement, because if I remember right, reading some of the history, there was some bloody wars coming up, led by different aristocracies.
Did you want to comment on his comment? Did you want to comment on his? Oh, okay. Hold on a second. In Jesus' day, the Mediterranean basin was all united politically. It was the Roman Empire. And there were provinces within it, Numidia, Egypt, Judea, Galatia, etc. But they were all united under a single secular political head. We saw that around 300, the empire was divided into two, north and or east and west. That gets reunited under Constantine, but the two halves become further apart. And then around 500, actually it's in 406, the Germans crossed the Rhine River because it had frozen over. The German tribes increasingly come down into the Roman Empire and trash it. Any organized political entities disappeared. And the culture reverted to feudalism, where the local political authority might have 1,000 or a couple thousand acres, or maybe 10,000, and everybody else living on it is his serf. He lives in the manor. In order to be allowed to subsist on the lord of the manor's land, he in turn promises that he will protect them if the manor is attacked, the land is attacked. Political unity disintegrates. And so you've got thousands of little tiny states, in a sense. Each manor is its own autonomous entity. The only political entity that survived from the ancient world was the church. And it, in fact, defended Rome. It was the papacy that defended Rome, not the senators, when the Lombards, one tribe of Germans, attacked them and so on in the 590s. Then the church aligns itself with one particular tribe, namely the Franks, who eventually settled in France, hence the name France. After three or four generations, a man emerges among the Frank dynasty, whose name is Charles the Great, in French, Charlemagne. And he reunites vast areas. Instead of each of these little tiny manors, maybe 1,000 of them, he reunites them all under his kingship. On Christmas Day in the year 800 AD, the Pope puts a crown on his head in the cathedral at Rome, saying, "You are now emperor." And to distinguish the new empire from the old one, the new one is called the Holy Roman Empire. So this is the origin of the Holy Roman Empire, 800. The Holy Roman Empire lasts until, depends on who you talk to, either 1807 or 1870, somewhere in there, about 150 years ago. So there is a struggle now between these two large entities, political entities. They're the only two large political entities. One is the papacy and one is the emperor. Sometimes the emperor had the upper hand, sometimes the papacy did. One of the ploys that was used by the emperor and also by the princes who larger than manors used to be, but they're still local rulers, was to invest a candidate with the bishop's staff and the bishop's mitre. This investing of a person of the local ruler's own choosing was called investiture. This resulted in what's called the investiture controversy, because the Pope said, wait a minute, that's my job. You guys aren't supposed to be picking bishops, I am. It went back and forth. The Pope excommunicated rulers when they would do this. The rulers in turn would threaten to march on Rome and so on. It all came to a head in 1077. In that year, Henry II, who was Holy Roman Emperor at that time, had refused to stop investing bishops. As a result, he was excommunicated, and it turned out everybody went against him. He had hoped everybody would back him and he could crush papal power once and for all, but instead, most Europeans went with the Pope. So he crossed the Alps in the middle of winter, barefoot. He went up to the castle where the Pope was staying in northern Italy and, you know, pulled the chain and said, can you hear my confession? So this is kind of the beginning of the monarchical papacy that we see in the Middle Ages, which reaches its apogee with Innocent III in 1215. It was Innocent III who founded the Franciscans and the Dominicans. I bring up all this because Germany, although nominally part of the Holy Roman Empire, was in fact a collection of fragmented political entities. At the time we're talking about, and even at the time of the Reformation. So Germany had a bunch of states, and they were not a United States. Each one was its own autonomous country. There was Saxony, there was Alsace, there was Lorraine, various ones. About maybe 200 of them. So your original question had to do with political influence on these sorts of things. I think that the fragmentary nature of Germany was one precondition for Lutheranism spreading the way it did. And I also think that resentment against this enormously powerful centralized political entity called the papacy was another reason why it spread so much. Got time for another one? She had one. I'm sorry.
Why did these early protesters not want to keep the tradition side of the faith? The early church fathers, they just disregarded them and took only the Bible? Was it because they were too involved with the ecumenical councils and so forth?
It wasn't so much the early church fathers that they wanted to get rid of as the hierarchy, in particular the papacy, in their own day. And they thought that the development of all of the traditions is what was the problem with the church. If we could get rid of bishops, if we could get rid of the Pope, if we could get rid of all these extra biblical practices that have arisen, like the rosary and so on, then we could return to the pure and simple church the way Jesus meant it to be back in the early day. So they thought if we just stick to the New Testament and ignore everything since, then we'll live in an ideal golden age of the faith. That same idea, I mentioned it in Judaism, that same idea, I think, is motivating some of fanatical Islam today. You know, everything was great when we all lived under a single caliph, you know, but once you let those Western notions in, all goes to heck.
I'd like to clear something up, and I'm backing up a little bit. In light of the death penalty and torture for confession as it relates to tradition, Is it the councils that chose tradition? I mean, I'm trying to understand. Torture and death penalty would be a tradition because it obviously was something that was done within the church. So how does this go away? Was it through the councils that this disappeared, or I'm not clear there.
I think that the church learned that it ought not to be imposing the death penalty because of a person's beliefs, the same way that everybody else learned it, by emerging into the modern world. Lutherans put people to death. Calvinists put people to death. Everybody put people to death back then. It was all the secular governments put people to death for their beliefs. And it was understood, nobody had ever conceived the possibility that a state could continue in existence and get along just fine without everybody belonging to the same religion. Even after the Reformation, everybody agreed that every country had to either choose to be a Lutheran country or a Calvinist country or a Catholic country. And once they chose, everybody in it had to be Catholic or Lutheran or Calvinist. And that's the way it was. Nobody could conceive the possibility of a country possibly surviving if it allowed different opinions concerning religious matters. It really isn't until the 1640s with the Puritans. Puritans were a minority group in England, and therefore they were very interested in seeing religious tolerance being promoted. At a meeting of the British Parliament in the 1640s, it's referred to as the Long Parliament, they promoted this idea. Why can't we have different religious groups all living in the same secular dominion? And this idea starts to catch on, so that 125 years later, the American Revolution occurs, and they have decided to incorporate that into their constitution for the first time in history. So it's a very recent development.
About how many people were damaged in the Inquisition? Do you have any feel for that? Was it tens of thousands or a million? I've heard numbers as low as 20,000.
I'm sure it was higher. I don't know. I would suspect it's higher than that, because even in the first decade of the Inquisition, we see 7,000 people being massacred in one town. So it's hard for me to believe it wouldn't have been more than 20,000 over a 400 or 500 year period. But as far as figures go, I have no idea. And I've never seen an attempt in print to determine that. One more? He said, one more, I guess.
In the period you're talking about tonight, don't you think the Catholic Church is more political? I mean, it was almost a state?
It was a state. Yes, it owned land. You know, the Papal States was the middle two-thirds of Italy. So it was a country alongside other countries, but it also was the overarching spiritual center for the whole of Christendom. I think it's a good thing that the church has ceased to be a temporal ruler. I think we're better off presently with our single square mile of Vatican City, you know, inside Rome, because it frees us to concentrate on spiritual matters, which is what the church exists for, rather than having to, you know, figure out how much produce are we getting from the farms and all the other stuff. I think it's a good thing. I guess that's it. Come on up afterward. Thank you all. And,